seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 080215 UT Southwestern Medical Center versus the estate of Irene Esther Arancibia.
You always so happy?
I normally am, especially today. I hope not.
May it please the court, Mr. Guy will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
The court, for two independent reasons, plaintiff's suit is barred under the controlling terms of the Tort Claims Act. First, plaintiffs failed to provide notice, which is a jurisdictional error under the 2005 amendment to the Government Code Section 311.034. Contrary to the holding below, that amendment does control in pending cases. The rule against retroactivity does not apply outside the limited context of substantive rules and vested rights. And because no one has the right to file a statutory action while, at the same time, ignoring the statute's very terms, retroactivity is simply not an issue in this case. Second, the Tort Claims Act election of remedies provision, section 101.106, independently precludes this action. The defendant employee invoked his absolute right under subsection F to be dropped from the suit, and plaintiffs failed to respond by dismissing the employee and adding the employer within the mandatory 30-day window.
Let's go back to the actual notice. The argument's been made that they had actual notice here. You've got the death of the patient, an immediate phone call saying something terrible has happened, an immediate request for risk management review. The purpose of risk management is to, you know, determine your potential culpability. Why would there not be actual notice in this situation? It seems like your brief contemplates that you have to admit fault for there to be actual notice.
I believe that this court standard in Simons actually imposes that as the burden. And Simons specifically rejected the notion that the death alone is sufficient to establish notice of fault.
A subjective awareness that its fault contributed to the claimed injury. And so all the governmental entity has to do is say, we weren't at fault.
Justice O'Neill, I think there are two important points. One, the facts in this case, and two, the reason why the standard is as high as it is. The facts in this case actually disprove any subjective awareness of fault or even contributing fault. The very email that noted the death and that called it a terrible outcome, and any death, whether it's expected or a result of negligence, is a terrible outcome, said that they went through the procedure and thought it went well, and quote, it went perfectly. That shows that the doctor in this case not only didn't think that they were at fault, but thought that the procedure as they performed it had been performed correctly.
So they'd have to say, boy, did I mess up.
They do, and the reason for that is that degree of subjective intent is what puts the defendant in the same position they would have been had the plaintiff provided the mandatory written notice under the Act.
I thought there was a discussion about this having been reviewed by a committee that in fact found that there was a violation of standards, but it was acceptable. Am I misreading the briefs somehow?
No, Your Honor, that's exactly right.
Was that a peer review committee or a quality control committee, or what committee was that?
It was a doctor who I believe is a member of the peer review committee. It's the first step of reviewing what happened, and he did conclude that there was a deviation, but found that their actions were acceptable, which is the opposite of negligence.
There's a deviation from the standard of care, but it was an acceptable deviation?
That's correct. It was not.
But doesn't that get subjective notice that there was a deviation from the standard of care? And that seems like that's what Justice O'Neill just talked about. We have subjective knowledge that there was a deviation from the standard, but we think it's all right, so therefore we don't have notice. Is that has to be, that's the position you're taking, it seems like.
It's a deviation from perhaps the exact way the procedure should have run, but that does not mean that the deviation showed negligence. In fact, they found that their conduct was acceptable, which again is the opposite of negligence.
What legal principle does that correlate to, an acceptable deviation?
There could be a set way that the procedure typically runs, and if it deviates a little, but not to the degree that would rise to medical negligence, that could be still an acceptable procedure. And in this case, it is the plaintiff's burden to show that they actually thought they were at fault. Now, maybe the court disagrees with the conclusion of the doctor who reviewed the file, and not only did he find it acceptable, but he elected not to elevate the case to the next standard, or to the next step of administrative review, precisely because it was acceptable conduct. So in this case, they need to show that the defendant was in the same position they would have been in had they received written notice. The written notice is what gives the defendant the full incentive, as this court explained in Simons, to investigate the accident.
I may not have understood your when you first began your remarks, but are you saying that 311.034 applies or does not apply?
It does apply to this case.
Okay. Retroactively? No, that's not the issue.
The issue is whether the application of that statute to this case would be retroactive under Texas law. And the retroactivity is a term of art, and it means a change in the law that affects a substantive rule or vested right. And in this case, it doesn't affect either substantive rules or vested rights, so the change in the law does apply to this pending case.
Okay, now my question is, and we'll get more into retroactivity in a moment, but there presumably are many pre-2005 cases before this statute was in effect that proceeded to judgment. If your argument is correct that there's no jurisdiction here, then in those cases that went to judgment and money changed hands are void. They should go away and the government gets its money back. Is that right or not?
No, Your Honor. Any case that has reached a final non-appealable judgment, it becomes vested. That then the plaintiff in those cases does have a substantive...
But the trial court never had jurisdiction over those cases. How would it ever become vested?
It would become vested so long as it became final before the act's effective date. The act's effective date is what kicks in the new jurisdictional stripping provision. Before that, any action that vests becomes a final judgment. The court at that time did have jurisdiction. It's only once the act becomes effective that a failure to provide notice does become a jurisdictional impediment instead of just a mandatory, you know, merits-based impediment to the plaintiff prevailing.
So vested right requires a judgment?
It requires a final non-appealable judgment. That's right, and I believe that in this case, it's clear that this statute doesn't affect substantive rights for at least four different reasons.
Counsel, let me stop just a moment. The Court of Appeals referenced a different statute that said that unless the legislature specifically says it's retrospective or retroactive, it's presumed not to be. Neither one of you seem to discuss that, but that's what the Court of Appeals kind of hung its hat on.
The Court of Appeals was wrong, and this is why. That statute assumes that the nature of the change would implicate a substantive rule or vested right.
It doesn't say that, though. It just says any statute.
It says any...
How do we get the extra words you're adding to it?
They're not extra words, Your Honor. Retroactive, again, is a term of art. When the legislature uses words like that in the Code Construction Act, they're legislating against the backdrop of precedent in both state courts and federal courts that have long established that a rule is not retroactive or retrospective if it's just a change in procedure or change in jurisdiction. And in this case, there is no change to any of the substantive rights at issue. The plaintiff, in fact, had no claim under pre-existing law because they failed to provide notice.
Are these your four reasons you were going to get into?
These are.
Okay.
The first is that there is no substantive right to file a procedurally defective claim. Once the plaintiff failed to provide notice and the defendant interposed a timely objection, that was sufficient under both Simons and Lutzenheiser for the case to be dismissed. So this isn't depriving the plaintiff of any right they had. No one ever has a right to invoke the statute and yet ignore what the statute says the plaintiff has to do to prevail at trial. The second reason is looking to the traditional lodestars of the retroactivity analysis, and this is reasonable reliance and settled expectations. No one ever has a reasonable expectation that anything will happen other than the case will be dismissed if they fail to file the mandatory prerequisites to suit. The third reason is that this is a statutory action. And another long-standing background principle of Texas law is that statutory actions, because they're provided at the discretion of the legislature, can also be repealed at the discretion of the legislature. Until the action has reached a final non-appealable judgment, which is what distinguishes this case from the cases that became final before the act's effective date, the action can actually be removed entirely. In this case, there's no change to the underlying substantive conduct or the substantive standards. There's no change to the procedure to enforce it. The only change is what happens when you fail to follow a mandatory procedure. And the fourth reason is that this
and
is...
And the change is the difference between no jurisdiction and dismissal.
That's exactly right.
Small.
It's extremely small, and in this case, the only practical effect is the timing of when the case will be dismissed. Under a rule where this is non-jurisdictional, the same result will happen. It'll just happen after the taxpayers and the plaintiffs have absorbed even more litigation expense, and the proper notice rule is finally applied on direct appeal after a needless trial.
It may be a small change between dismissal and no jurisdiction, but before the act, there was no consequence to failing to give notice, especially when the trial proceeds and discovery. I mean, there was litigation going on here for a year or so, and under prior law, the litigation could continue, and the question of notice goes away. Isn't that right?
That's wrong, Your Honor.
Wrong.
Well, once the defendants amended their answer, under Texas law, defendants have the right to amend their answer even after trial. The trial has gone on for a while. This hadn't reached a trial. They were still in the discovery stage and the motion stage. They amended their answer. The plaintiffs didn't object to the amended answer, and the amended answer raised the notice defense. So at that point, there was a hearing on the notice defense. And if the lower court had found that, in fact, notice wasn't provided and that actual notice was inadequate in this case, the case would be dismissed. So the only effect in this case is whether the actual notice inquiry will be determined immediately on interlocutory appeal and potentially, and we submit, it should be dismissed on those grounds and save jurors time from coming to it for a needless trial, and the taxpayers' time in defending these suits, and the plaintiffs the time in trying to litigate this action. It just gives an immediate resolution as the legislature intended through the interlocutory appellate jurisdiction statute. And we do think it's very important to realize that there is a reason that the Simon standard is so high for actual notice, and that's providing written notice is the ordinary way that the legislature intended in the vast majority of claims, and in fact in every claim where plaintiffs actually should do it, to provide notice to the defendant entity. The actual notice is
in
a backstop.
In Simons, though, there was an auger attached to the tractor's power takeoff, and I believe the plaintiff had a wrench attached to it or something, and it was engaged, and the wrench came around and hit him. So maybe he shouldn't have had the wrench on the auger. Maybe the auger shouldn't have been, maybe the tractor shouldn't have been running. But anyway, there are lots of scenarios where different people could have been at fault, or maybe nobody was really at fault. But is a perforated bowel different? I mean, here, is there anything in the record that we have that would indicate that perforated bowels just happen like wrenches on power takeoffs and... that it can happen outside someone's negligence?
Yes, Your Honor, and in fact, we have the best evidence of that in the record is the review of the doctor who looked at the procedure and found that the conduct was adequate and acceptable.
Well, acceptable, you know, I don't know if that means that bad things sometimes happen, but it's still the doctor's fault. I mean, the bowel shouldn't be perforated.
That's certainly true, but sometimes any invasive surgery, and this is an invasive surgery, comes with the risk that sometimes accidents do happen. Accidents don't always rise to the level of medical negligence. There could be a deviation from procedure that is still acceptable, where the conduct was still within professional standards, in the same way that a trial lawyer might miss some objections at trial but still not commit malpractice in the legal sense. It's not true that just because something bad happened, that shows that they understood they were at fault. And that is the standard that Simon sets, because that is the level of knowledge that puts the defendant on notice that they need to investigate and prepare a defense in the same way that they would have had they received written notice. And written notice is so easy to provide.
But you'd admit there's a weird sort of procedural conundrum under 101-106-B. Because you don't have to give notice to the individual doctors. But then if the individual doctors move to substitute the governmental entity, what happens to notice? And there's just sort of a gap there in the statutory scheme.
we submit that there is no gap, Your Honor.
Well, of course you do,
The notice requirement is categorical. It doesn't draw any exceptions, and the legislature could have drawn an exception if it chose to do that. And the purpose of notice, the notice requirement applies, whether the defendant is the initial defendant in the case or a substituted defendant. They still have the same need to start collecting evidence and prepare a defense within 6 months of the accident. It shouldn't be up to the plaintiffs to essentially create what will be a broad sweeping end run around the notice requirement by simply suing the employee, watching as the employee predictably drops out of the case because they have the absolute right to do that. And it's the rare employee who chooses that they would rather face the lawsuit when they could substitute in the employer on their behalf. I see my time has expired.
Are there any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Caulfield will present argument for the respondents.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Your Honor, we're confronted with something of a circular argument this morning because, in essence, the government is asking us to determine the notice issue before we determine whether or not the court has jurisdiction to determine the notice issue. And that is because the government is arguing that noncompliance with the notice issue means that there was no vested right, therefore the notice statute does not have retroactive application. And so, with court's permission, I'll begin with the notice issue itself, which was Justice O'Neill's opening question regarding actual notice. There are actually three reasons why written notice was not required. First is because written notice is never required for individual employees that are sued in their individual capacity. Section 101.101A provides that a governmental unit is entitled to receive notice of a claim against it. Now,
but now you're suing the government. But now you're suing the government.
We are now, Your Honor, but only because of the operation of 106F.
So you think F excuses 101A?
At the time suit was initiated, pre-suit notice was only required for governmental units who weren't sued. Suit was initiated, and then there was no pre-suit notice requirement engrafted into the Act in any of the other sections. 106F requires that upon the motion of an individual employee who is working within the scope of his employment with a governmental unit, and when the governmental unit can be sued under the Tort Claims Act, the individual may move for dismissal and the governmental unit may be substituted in his or her place.
30 days, but it doesn't say and the notice provision in 101.101 is excused in that circumstance.
It doesn't say that, Your Honor, but there never is a notice requirement. There never is a pre-suit notice requirement that arises.
There is for the government, for a governmental entity.
There is for the government, but,
right.
Your Honor, there is no requirement to give that pre-suit notice to the government when only an employee is being sued in his individual capacity.
But subsection F says, if the suit against the employee is based on conduct within the scope of the employee's employment, and if it could have been brought under this chapter against the governmental unit.
Correct.
And it cannot have been brought against the governmental unit without the notice.
Interestingly enough, that argument has actually been raised by the plaintiff's bar in an effort to eradicate individual immunity under 106F and has been rejected. The Court of Appeals in Bailey versus Sanders, San Antonio Court of Appeals in 2008, was confronted with this same argument. The plaintiff's bar raised the argument that whenever no notice is provided to the governmental entity, 106F can never come into play because the governmental entity could not have been sued under the Tort Claims Act. Therefore, according to the argument that was raised in Bailey by the plaintiffs, there can be no immunity for the individual employees. Now, the court rejected that because, as we state in our brief, it simply makes no sense to apply it in this manner. If so, then the very purpose of 106F, which is to afford immunity to governmental employees, is negated. Instead, the Act should be read as the Act is written, that there is only a pre-suit notice requirement whenever the governmental unit is sued.
So, let me make sure I understand you. So, you're the plaintiff and you realize that your notice time has passed, so you choose then to sue the individuals knowing that the individuals will switch out to the governmental entity and then you don't have to worry about the notice.
Your Honor is presenting the problem with the way the statute is written, which is it's subject to gamesmanship on both sides. And that is a problem with the way this statute is drafted. However, that problem wasn't presented in this case. In this case,
you have the cite for that.
Yes, Your Honor, I do. That is 261 Southwest 3rd, 154.
Thank you.
But can the statute be read to avoid that gamesmanship?
Your Honor, the statute can be read to avoid the gamesmanship in this case by providing that no actual notice, that no written notice needs to be provided to government.
Addressing Justice Green's problem, I mean, of course, we've got your particular facts in your case before us, but in interpreting the statute, we've got to make sure that it is consistent with no gamesmanship if the statute can be read that way, reasonably.
Your Honor, the statute can be read in such a way as to fit within the example that was given, that if the notice period, the six-month notice period has expired, then there is no notice required if the individuals are brought into the lawsuit. That's correct. That then the only restraint is going to be the statute of limitations.
You said there were three reasons why written notice is not required. I think you got through one, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
What are the others?
The other two, first, Your Honor, that actual notice has been provided, and the court has already addressed this briefly. There is not only an email chain that describes, quote, the terrible outcome of the surgery, including identity of the parties, the doctors, and Mrs. Aaron Sibia, the decedent, the actual injury, which was piercing of the bowel, and the resulting death, including times, which is all that's required for notice underneath Simons. There was further the report that was referenced, and that report at page 298 and 299 of the clerk's record states on the bottom, this form is for risk management, quality management use only. The form goes on to state in handwritten notes, a technical error occurred during the original hernia operation resulting in a through and through small bowel injury. The patient died of sepsis. And as noted by the court, there was a deviation noted from established standards, but it was deemed to be acceptable. Now, one of the questions that was raised by the court was whether or not the fact that the hospital itself said, well, it's acceptable, means that Simons hasn't been fulfilled. The holding of Simons was to clarify the second of the Cathy factors, that the governmental unit's alleged fault be provided in the notice. The actual holding is that there must be subjective awareness of its fault as ultimately alleged by the claimant in producing the claimed injury. I think that language is important because it focuses on as ultimately alleged by the claimant. There doesn't need to be an admission of fault. There has to be knowledge of fault as ultimately alleged by the claimant. And that was certainly present in this case. In this case, the through and through bowel perforation that caused the sepsis, the septicemia and the death was acknowledged just days after this incident and was reported to risk management. So there was actual notice in this case.
It did, and it did not go any further beyond the one physician.
Your Honor, that physician chose to not send this further in the review process. They checked off a box that said, yes, there are deviations, but I find them acceptable. Do not forward this to the committee.
And there was no peer review of any nature other than that insofar as...
In the records that were produced to us, there was no further peer review.
Let me ask you, separate and apart from the actual notice issue, the substitution out of the governmental unit, the plaintiff has 30 days to file amended pleadings. How can the individual doctors agree to extend the deadline on behalf of the governmental unit by a Rule 11 agreement?
106F has been analyzed by several different court of appeals on that particular issue. Is it an automatic dismissal after 30 days, or does there have to be some proof given? In fact, most of the courts of appeals have decided that there has to actually be proof, that since it is a motion, the movement bears the burden of proof, and they must establish the three factors that are required, which is that the employee is a governmental entity, that the suit is based on conduct within the scope of their employment, and that suit could have been brought against the governmental entity underneath the Tort Claims Act. We cite one case in our brief, also Hall versus Protos, Phillips versus DeFonte, and a case that's currently pending before this court, Franca versus Velasquez, have ruled that there's more than just filing the motion, that the motion actually has to have proof. Franca versus Velasquez is particularly interesting because in that case, there was a fact issue that was raised. The movement said, well, I've raised a fact issue, the statute says in 30 days, you have to dismiss the case. The court said that's inherently unfair. Because if only a fact issue is sufficient, or indeed if just filing a motion is sufficient, or in this case as alleged, filing an answer that references the statute is sufficient, then this automatic dismissal can result in dismissal of individual employees when in fact the other requirements are not met. They weren't in the scope of their employment. In fact, it will be proved later in the case. Or they weren't or the governmental entity could not have been sued. It may be proven later in the case, in which case there is no remedy left to the plaintiff. They have been automatically dismissed from the suit under 106F, and they have no recourse against the governmental unit. We would urge the court to follow this same sort of reasoning, but you don't need to go as far as the court in Franca versus Velazquez in this case, because there was only an answer that was filed. The answer referenced the statute, including in its prayer for relief, that it be given the statutory relief, but it didn't attach any evidence. It didn't seek to prove the elements. In fact, it didn't list the elements.
If there were evidence, could the parties extend the deadline by Rule 11 agreement?
Your Honor, I think the reasoning of these statutes would allow Rule 11 agreement to be put into place.
How is that?
Because, Your Honor, this is a motion, again, that must be proven. It falls within the rules of civil
proven.
It falls within the rules of civil procedure to that extent. And so before the hearing is held, if the parties enter into a Rule 11 agreement that they will not file a motion, certainly that would be appropriate. No motion is filed. This is never triggered. If a motion is filed and the motion has not yet been heard and the proof hasn't yet been provided to the court, then I believe a Rule 11 agreement, and I think the authorities support this, would be appropriate and extend the time to have that motion heard. The problem in this case is that the motions had not been heard.
Well, suppose the hardest case. There is evidence. It is heard. Can the parties still extend the deadline?
That is the hardest case, Your Honor.
Yeah.
unfortunately, I don't have a very clean answer for you. But
if the answer is no, then why should they be able to do it any other way? That's the next question.
If the answer is no,
if the answer is no, which it would seem to be, they can't extend it, then why should they be able to extend it because there was a delay in the hearing or they wanted to deduce proof or some other reason?
Well, I think the answer can be no in that situation and yes in the others, based upon the language of Section 106F. Section 106F is conditional. It says if this factor is met and if the other factor is met, and those comprise the three factors that I read to the court earlier, then a plaintiff may move. And upon such motion, 30 days after, the case shall be dismissed. The section itself seems to be contingent upon establishing those factors. Therefore, in Your Honor's situation, the answer could still be no, that those factors have been established. And so after that point, there could not be an extension.
So under your argument, the Rule 11 agreement really is a red herring. You wouldn't need the Rule 11 agreement.
Well, you wouldn't need to have the Rule 11 agreement in that particular scenario. Now, again, in our case, the Rule 11 agreement was entered before Dr. Watson ever filed his motion. And in fact, he didn't file the motion until January 20th, and the case was dismissed against him, and the governmental entity was brought in on January 28th. And so we don't really have the problems that we're focused in on here.
But there is a problem as to two of the doctors in there.
Dr. Yao and yes, Your Honor, there is a problem as to them. And they fit within that second scenario, which is where there has been a motion filed, but that there has not been a motion heard yet by the court.
And under both of those scenarios, the Rule 11 is irrelevant.
I believe the Rule 11 could be used to extend the period of time for the proof and underneath the reading of 106F. If those issues have not yet been established, since 106F is contingent upon those issues being established, then a Rule 11 agreement could be effective to extend the date of the hearing. Now, Your Honor, briefly in the time that's remaining to me, unless there's any further questions on the notice issues, and the third issue, since Your Honor is keeping track, the third issue is going to be the argument under 106F that requiring notice can lead to gamesmanship, which has already been addressed in an earlier discussion. Now, turning to the retroactivity question. In Lautzenheiser, this court said that the notice provisions of the Tort Claims Act were not jurisdictional. Now, the issue in Lautzenheiser was not whether those issues could be raised at any point in litigation, but whether they could be raised in a plea to the jurisdiction. This court determined that they could not because they were not jurisdictional. The response of the legislature was Section 311.034. The legislature, in an obvious attempt to legislatively overturn the judicial decision of Lautzenheiser, simply stated that these determinations of notice and the other conditions precedent were jurisdictional. Of course, we don't have a definition of what jurisdictional means. And jurisdictional, as noted in the brief, can mean a variety of different things. But we do know what they were trying to address, and they were trying to address the fact that these notice issues could not be raised in a pleaded jurisdiction under Lautzenheiser. The intent seems to be that they could be raised under a pleaded jurisdiction after the statute was brought into effect. Now, there is a prohibition against retroactivity, of course, in the Texas Constitution that is much more clear than in the federal Constitution, found in Article 1, Section 16, and enforced under Article 1, Section 29. Statutes, as a result, are deemed to be prospective only, or presumed to be prospective only. Indeed.
Before you go to the constitutional argument, do you agree with opposing counsel on the statutory argument that the Court of Appeals used? It just said that the statute does not distinguish between procedural or substantive or vested rights. It just says any statute. And he takes the position that doesn't apply when it's only procedural or remedial. Are you in agreement with that, or do you with your opponent's position, or do you disagree with that?
I agree with both the lower court and its interpretation of 311.022 and with this court in the Subaru case in its analysis of the prospective presumption.
So if we go with that position, you don't even need to talk about the Constitution. Is that correct?
Well,
because it's not retroactive. It doesn't specifically say so.
And Your Honor, I would say this is actually a codification of constitutional law. Landgraf recognized that this has been a long-held presumption. That the statute is going to be prospective as opposed to retroactive.
But if you violate the Constitution, it's void. The statute just tells us how to interpret other laws.
Well, that's actually an interesting question, Your Honor, because under Article 1, Section 29, if a statute is deemed to be retroactive, it's also void.
Right.
So.
But the statute doesn't. One statute's not going to void another one. It just tells us how to interpret it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And it's a codification, like I said, of the general presumption of prospective application. The Landgraf court explained why that presumption should be applied. And again, Landgraf was a remedies case, essentially. It's similar to this because it was the addition of a new remedy underneath federal law for a cause of action. Landgraf said that requiring clear intent assures that Congress itself has affirmatively considered the potential unfairness of retroactive application and determined that it's an acceptable price to pay for the countervailing benefits. We don't have that sort of consideration by Congress here. In fact, the statute doesn't say it should be applied retroactively at all. And so the presumption should remain in place of prospective application. Now, the argument has been raised that this is merely a procedural rule. But as Justice Bradley back in 1885 mentioned in a dissenting opinion, remedies are the life of rights. And that was essentially what this court recognized in the Likes case. In the Likes case, this court looked at a change to the Tort Claims Act, and it recognized that where there has been a change in the remedy, there can be a disruption of the right. And where that right is abolished, where the remedy is completely abolished, then there can be an improper retroactive application of the statute. That's what's happened in this case. In Likes, the change allowed the plaintiff time to amend their pleadings. Plaintiff's cause of action accrued several months before the change in law was to go into effect. In this case, there was no opportunity to amend any potential defect. Assuming that written notice was ever required, pre-suit written notice could not be provided in this case a year after the litigation was commenced, which is when the plea of the jurisdiction was filed. And so, contrary to Likes, the remedy, when it was eradicated, took away the life of the right. And so a vested right was affected.
Okay, let me just follow up real quickly on the 30-day, the extension of the 30-day requirement. I was a little bit confused by your argument there. The statute says the employee can move for dismissal of the suit unless the plaintiff files amended pleadings dismissing the employee and names the governmental unit as defendant on or before the 30th day after the date the motion is filed. I took it from your answer that it had to have been granted, and the 30 days extended the discovery period to prove the elements that's necessary for the grant. But this just says after the date the motion is filed.
And this is the problem the courts of appeals are struggling with in trying to interpret this provision. Of course, if there is a proof element required, then simply 30 days after filing doesn't work.
But that's what the statute says.
And the statute in Section 106F begins, if a suit is filed against the employee based on conduct from the general scope of the employee's employment, and if it could have been brought under this chapter, the suit is considered to be against the employee in the employee's official capacity only, on the employee's motion, and then it continues on to the section that was read by Your Honor.
The statute is
written to be conditional in this manner.
But it seems to put the plaintiff to a choice in that instance. The plaintiff's got to decide whether to ride the within the course and scope horse or the outside the course and scope horse. And replete through this act is the forcing of that choice early on, right or wrong. It seems to be the plain language.
And that's, Your Honor, one of the reasons that I'm glad not to be the counsel of Franco versus Velasquez, which is the case that does squarely present these issues. As we noted in our motions and our responses to the petition, this case doesn't squarely present that issue. But I can certainly address your question. And that is a concern that the plain language of the Act does require dismissal after 30 days of the filing of the motion. What I believe the Franca Court is getting at is what this court noted in the Riata Construction Corporation versus City of Dallas case, which is that sovereign immunity is essentially a common law concept, and that this court may modify sovereign immunity when its application would be unfair. I see that my time is up.
Finish your thoughts.
Okay. When it sees that the application would be unfair, in the Riata case, it would be unfair for a governmental entity to sue and bring affirmative claims against an entity, but not be allowed to be sued in return. It may very well be that under the construction of this Section 106F, that it would be inherently unfair to have a mechanism whereby half of the potential right, which is against either the individual in their individual capacity or the government, is taken away within 30 days without any real notice, opportunity, due process to have that determination made. And that this court may very well decide under its Riata holding and its right to govern the common law that would be improper.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel.
Support. A few quick points. The first is that this court does need to determine the jurisdictional question in order to determine its own jurisdiction, just as the court recognized in both Simons and Lutzenheiser. So the predicate issue before we get to whether actual notice was met is whether this is a jurisdictional question in the first place.
But if there's actual notice, then the jurisdictional question doesn't arise.
It does, Your Honor, because this comes up on interlocutory appeal, this court only has jurisdiction to address jurisdictional issues. So before the court can determine whether notice is either met or not, whether we prevail on the merits or not of that issue, it first has to determine whether it's jurisdictional in the first place. And we submit that this is clearly a law that does not implicate the retroactivity concerns. My opposing counsel referenced a Landgraf decision. Landgraf pointed out that there are two competing strands of case law. These are the same competing strands that this court has recognized time and again in its decisions extending back over a century, which is laws that change and affect substantive rules and vested rights are presumed not to apply retroactively under federal law and are banned from applying retroactively under state law. But laws that do not implicate those substantive rules and vested rights are presumed to apply immediately to all pending cases.
Any of those cases interpret this statute?
I believe in Subaru, to the extent it mentioned it, it acknowledged that retroactivity concerns, precisely because retroactivity is a term of art, are implicated only if the change in the law implicates substantive rights.
But Subaru, we said, really what we're talking about is a different form. We're not going to extinguish your right. You can do it. You just have to exhaust administrative remedies at the agency before you come up. So it didn't ultimately get rid of the case.
It may not have, Your Honor, but I think here, too, if someone did have a valid claim, notwithstanding their failure to provide notice, they could take that to the legislative forum. And the law does not guarantee any particular tribunal, even a judicial tribunal, especially to try a statutory action, and most definitely to try an action that the plaintiff has failed to meet the controlling prerequisites to maintaining that cause of action in the first place. This simply does not implicate any substantive or vested right the Likes case is not to the contrary. In that case, the court was looking at a common law, a vested common law action, not a statutory action. And in any event, I believe Likes actually rejected the claim precisely because there was a period where the right could have vested.
Justice Heck asked a question about the perforated bowel, and if this is a little different maybe than a power takeoff on a tractor. What more would the hospital have done if they had been given notice of claim other than what they did? They had the doctor that scrubbed, looked at it, the doctor that supervised looked at it, had another physician look at it. They knew exactly what was involved. What more would they have done had they received notice that someone was making a claim that they violated the standard of care by perforating the bowel?
Well, hypothetically, and it is a hypothetical because they weren't provided the written notice so we could see what they really would have done, presumably they would have gone to the second step of administrative review that was
looked
cut off.
They'd have looked at the same facts with an expert, with experts looking at it. You've already had two experts, one the supervising physician, one the reviewing physician. Both of them presumably were experts in this particular area. So all you would have done was had another set of experts look at it.
And presumably, if they reached the same conclusions as these two experts, they would have concluded that the hospital was not at fault. And the Simon standard looks to actual subjective awareness. So it doesn't matter what we might think looking at this and saying, there's a deviation from the standard of care. That sounds like negligence to us. They
but
thought it was
isn't
acceptable.
Isn't the answer, though, that if they got the notice, they would have sent it over to risk management, which is what they did?
It's unclear what else they would have done, but the same standard has to apply to an entity that doesn't receive written notice and that doesn't take the same care in investigating matters just to see what possibly happened. The inquiry notice is not enough. It has to be actual subjective awareness. It doesn't matter what we think. It matters what the hospital thought. And they thought the procedure was acceptable. The doctor who attended the procedure thought it went perfectly. That is the opposite of believing you are actually at fault for the injury. And there is also an easy way for the 101-106 interaction with this and the Tort Claims Act notice provision to avoid gamesmanship. And that's plaintiffs are on notice that almost every employee will substitute out the employer whenever they're sued. So the answer is provide written notice to both the employer and the employee, even if you intend to sue only the employee at first.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.